Great. So I'm going to be talking about some of the work we've been doing concerning sequence analysis using likelihoods. This is joint work with a number of different folks. The selection analysis stuff I'll be talking about at the end is joint with Trevor. We have a great time talking to the statistician Vladimir Menon at the University of Washington. Duncan Ralph is my postdoc who really gets bold because he did an incredible job doing the software engineering for the HMM side of things, and it's really great to have for that. And David just started and has done a couple of data analysis things. So before I get too far, I just wanted to thank the organizers, of course, for having us here, and thank all of you for helping me learn immunology. So I'm quite new to immunology, and it's been a great experience to chat with all of you.
This is to show us that you get up very early in the morning.
I do get up very early in the morning.
It's sunrise.
But it's
sunset.
Well, no, yeah. Okay, so as you can tell from my talk title, the philosophy that I'm going to apply is a little bit different. There's going to be a lot of commonality with previous talks. So previous talks, I mean, we've all been talking about modeling immune cells, right? No. And so for us, we're interested in B cells in particular, and we're interested in doing this probabilistically. And like, for instance, the previous talk and a number of other talks, we're also interested in inferring parameters using likelihoods. Sort of a key difference between this talk and some of the others is that we just want to plow this back into doing sequence analysis. So we want to take all of those interesting insights that we found about the parameters and use those to improve the sequence analysis side of things. And I should definitely say that this is a work in progress. So I come from statistical phylogenetics. This is actually the core of my group works in statistical phylogenetics. And just to sort of set the stage, we can just say that for that field, basically we develop probabilistic models for sequence evolution. So this is also quite similar. We write down a likelihood function, and then we search for the maximum likelihood tree. And this search is provably difficult, so you have to use optimization heuristics in order to find this maximum likelihood tree. So, or we integrate using MCMC. So, maybe I don't have to motivate this likelihood-based analysis for this sort of audience, but likelihood-based analysis purely provides a solid statistical foundation for doing analysis. So that's not. So we're going to be getting there. This is sort of just phylogenetics in general, but yeah, I'll be talking about lineage trees. Okay, so this is you might see some common elements of this figure from Thierry's talk. That's because Kurt shared with me his beautiful picture with these things curving up, but we sort of extended it a little bit. Maybe I don't need to go over this too much, but just to establish the iconography. So there's a collection of V genes, D genes, and J genes. They get trimmed to some amount and then creates a naive B cell. This is stimulated to reproduce by exposure to antigen, and then this stimulates affinity maturation through somatic hypermutation. So really one of the key goals that we have in the group is to do this inference problem. So we can imagine each individual having a whole bunch of lineage trees. We do sequencing, and we want to reconstruct what these lineage trees are and what all the mutation events that led to the lineages. Of course, this is not possible, as stated, but we're going to try our best. So we can break this down into a series of steps. I'm not going to be talking about generating high-quality data, which is, of course, hard and not something that we do. But we're going to be talking about annotation of BCR sequences, finding clonal families, reconstructing trees, finding ancestral sequences, and then evolutionary selection inference. So all this in a probabilistic framework. So we are research parasites, if any of you know that term. So we don't make our own data. And the data that I'm going to be using for this talk is from Adaptive. Well, part of it's from Adaptive, similar to what the El Hanati paper used. And also from this recent paper that was about, this is barcoded data, though perhaps not as over-sequenced as would have been great to have. But so these are the two data sets we're going to be using. And then the first task that we set before ourselves is this BCR sequence annotation. So just to double check, make sure people are with me. So we have a sequence that comes directly off the sequencer, and we want to go from this back to reconstruct what this was up here. So we want, for every nucleotide, we want to say what V, D, and J gene was it from? And what's the boundary in between the germline coded V region and this DJ, and then these various insertion regions? So we're going to use a hidden Markov model to talk about this. And I know that many people are probably familiar with HMMs, but things are going to get a little bit crazy with the HMMs eventually. So I just want to make sure everybody's on the same page. Okay. Well, great. Then I will explain them. So the canonical way of explaining, of sort of example that one might use for an HMM is this dishonest casino. So we imagine that we have two die. There's this blue one and a green one. So the blue one is fair. This is a normal die. The green one is not fair in that it tends to roll ones more probably than other ones. So the game, a game that bioinformaticians like to play is, say I'm behind some partition and I have one of each of these. And what I'm going to do is I'm going to be rolling one of these die at a time. And then at some, you know, every once in a while, I'm going to switch the die around. And you need to figure out, when am I switching the dice around and which die is being rolled at each time. So we have this probability of switching is, say, some parameter P. And I give you a series of, these are called missions, but basically just the outcome of the different rolls. So now just naively, you can just sort of look at this and say, well, okay, this one's more likely to roll ones. So we can say, well, perhaps we were rolling the green die here, and then we switched over to the blue die over here. That was the third one. And you can cast this in a probabilistic way, and you can say, what is the maximum likelihood assignment of states to these nodes? So when I say maximum likelihood, I mean the maximum of the probability of emitting each one of these states along with the probability of making all these transitions. So this is sort of no transition and then one transition and so on. So you can see that, for instance, if P was really big, if there was sort of no barrier for me exchanging the dice, perhaps the maximum likelihood assignment would be to always take green when we have a one and then switch to blue when we don't have a one. But for this example, we're assuming that P is somewhat small, that it's sort of rare that I switch these things around compared to the number of times I'm rolling them. So this is one way of looking at HMMs. Any questions about this? Okay. So this is perhaps a more typical way of drawing HMMs. And now we've just sort of duplicated things. We have one set of sites for the green and one for the blue. And now what we just need to do is make a path through this HMM. So again, our probability is these probabilities of emission multiplied by these probabilities of transition and so on. Okay. So of course, this is just a metaphor. What we're actually interested in doing is doing VDJ assignment. And if the HMM stuff didn't quite make sense, we can just imagine that we have all of the V genes here laid out, all of the D genes, and all of the J genes. And we have our sequence, which is sort of in this magenta color. And we're just sort of like matching it along for as long as it seems like it matches. And then we're going in this non-templated insertion state and then moving to the next gene and so on. But we're doing this in this probabilistic way, and the top assignment is going to be the one that takes us through this in the maximum likelihood way.
So what are your dices there? Each line?
Yes. So the dice, so each, yeah. Okay, so each one of these genes is represented by a series of states.
Each state is a given
position. Each state is a given position in a germline gene. And the dice is the bias dice that corresponds to the mutation of that site. So it's biased towards germline. So if this site in this germline gene is a G, the dice is very biased to rolling a G. But it might not. It might give you something else. So that's what the emissions are. So we are observing DNA sequences that are results of following through this process. That's what the emissions are. And then these probability transitions are what is the probability that we move to the next site in the germline gene, rather than moving up, like completing this gene and moving on to the non-templated insertions.
So, but when it doesn't roll a G, then this is an error or
something?
It's a, it's, yeah, a typical, well, right, a mutation.
And this is one of the parameters you learn, right?
Yes.
And it's the same everywhere. The part, the probability of an error of a mutation, it's one parameter.
No, it varies.
It varies according to the...
Across, like, different positions in the gene.
Are you going to assume, what are you going to assume you know, like, for example, in your HMM thing, you're not assuming you know the underlying markup chain, right?
He's learning it, basically.
Yeah, learning the parameters of the model, but the structure of the HMM is fixed.
Okay, so the structure is fixed, but you're going to assume you know nothing else?
Yeah.
That and so,
then we learn those parameters.
I understand. Yeah. But even when I HMM, you can decide that some things, you know, like for IRI, like the relative frequencies of various Ps or whatever.
Yeah, all that stuff. So the way it's set up now is it's really optimized for large data sets where we sort of learn everything on the fly.
Okay.
So I'll be talking to exhaustion about ways to aggregate parameters later in the talk, but that's not quite here yet.
Do you do this for a given V?
For a given, so each one of these things represents a V gene, for instance. Mm-hmm. We do this, yeah, for data sets that contain lots of Vs. I don't think I'm quite getting your question.
Well, you're doing this for a real sequence, right?
Yeah.
But you don't know the V.
But you don't know the V, so how do you get the V from alignment?
We also do this sort of recursive thing where you do annotation and then parameter estimation. We don't do as elegant of a job about integrating out the uncertainty, and we're probably going to come back to that. But we're learning these parameters from the data.
But you have a parameter of V usage?
Yes.
And it's a parameter you learn?
Yes.
It's just V usage, or it's V J usage, or it's like...
You're asking, is it a joint distribution?
Yeah. This is a bit like a lot of...
Okay, we'll talk. Yeah, okay. Just as Thierry was talking about, so these distributions are sort of unusual, but they're reproducible between individuals. So these are sort of what we infer, for instance, how many sites were deleted off the end of this particular V gene. So this is saying that the most likely thing to happen was that there was no deletion at all. And it's unlikely that there was one nucleotide deleted and so on. So we infer these things. And I want to give credit where credit is due. I mean, this all sort of started back from this 2012 paper where they also, this is for TCRs, but they also observed this sort of reproducible but rather different between gene distribution of deletions.
So the blue, doesn't
you're happy to, you feel free to comment on your own.
No. That's my guess. What is the blue? Yeah. I don't remember the blue.
I thought it was a model.
Oh, the average is the green.
I thought it was a model.
Oh, the model, that was the model, remember?
Okay. Well, so I don't, sorry to put you on the spot.
It is the model. So
I don't want to talk too much about simulation and such so on, but like this, like using these detailed sets of parameters appears in our hands to do a better job of this annotation problem than than others. So what this is showing is how far the simulated unmutated ancestor was from the simulated sort of memory sequence, and how frequently you see this. So we want to be pushed as far this way as we can. So this is a sort of everything without cheating. So we do sort of a little bit better, but you can see that if you have a bunch of sequences that you know are from the same clonal family, that you do a lot better. But I'm still sort of like not especially satisfied with this.
Sorry, go ahead. Can you explain what this
shows? So we have a simulated sequence, and then sort of the simulated mutated sequence. And we want to go back and infer what the unmutated ancestor was, so what the original sequence was.
So what was the process by which you make the simulated mutated sequence?
Yeah, this is why.
So you're kind of trying to do the inverse problem in the circumstances where the thing that created the mutated sequence is actually the model you're imposing.
It's not exactly the same model. It's a more complicated model. But I there's a lot of ideas that I want to get through, but we can talk about validation a bit. I just want to say, I really think this is all because of the increased detail of the model that's reflecting the underlying biology. So, okay.
So can I just ask you?
Yeah.
Okay, so
there are others who have worked with HMMs going back to 2005. But all of these use standard probability distributions for the parameters, such as deletion lengths. But we saw that these are spiky and quite interesting distributions, so it's worth learning them. So we use these parameter-rich HMMs. This is work that's published in PLOS Comp Bio. And then recently, Yuval and company's HMM has appeared on the archive. Ours is not quite as fancy as
Yuval. So what's the difference between, because the way you described it, it sounds exactly like Yuval.
We actually use a geometric distribution for insertion.
Okay, so you don't learn the insertion.
No, they do learn, but they
assume a model class for the insertion.
Yeah.
But for the V and J's, then you do all the same.
Our parameter fitting is not quite as fancy. We should probably take this offline. Okay, because I think that this next section for the HMM. The next section is really interesting. So this is sort of likelihood-based things. Simon here also has a likelihood-based approach for doing the same problem, but it's a phylogenetic approach. I'm not going to talk about that. Maybe he'll talk about it. Okay. So. What we sort of learned, and what Thierry also said, is that it's that sort of reconstructing exactly the events that led to a given BCR receptor is quite difficult, and it's sort of an error-prone process. So we would like to somehow use this annotation information to answer this question, which is, given a bunch of sequences, what were the clonal families? So we're forgetting about the structure of the tree, but we don't want to use that information in too rigid of a way. So that's sort of the challenge. Is the question clear? Okay, so this is what I was saying, that things were going to get a little bit crazy with the HMMs. So now we're going to play a new game. And remember, before you wanted to figure out, you know, when was I rolling a green die versus a blue die? So this is a new game. We're not doing that. All you need to know is decide whether I'm doing one of two games. So either I only have one die being rolled at a time, but I'm rolling it twice, and then switching, and then rolling twice again. Or do I have two independent die rolling games? So do I have two sets of dice such that I'm sort of rolling them and then switching probabilistically and so on? So what you're going to get in order to decide whether it's one or another is you get a series of pairs of annotations. So what this is saying is that in the first sort of session of the game, I rolled a five. I gave you a five and a one, and then a one and a four, and so on. So if we assume that I just have a single die at a given time, this is what could, this is sort of a type of pair HMM. So what this is saying is that if I'm in this state, I'm rolling a 5 and a 1 from the same die. And so I can calculate a marginal probability about, you know, what is the likelihood of generating this sequence without having to specify a particular sequence of red and blue. I can calculate it just using this hypothesis of a pair HMM. And the other hypothesis is just sort of two copies of the previous HMM, where they're sort of independently going through these paths. So the question is, do these two sequences form a single unknown path through the distribution? So Thierry already showed this, that we can calculate the marginal probability of observing a given sequence by summing over all paths. But we can also do the same thing with our pair HMM. We can say, what is the marginal probability of observing a pair of sequences summing over all paths? But the key point here is that X and Y are generated from the same path through the HMM. So what does this correspond to in the VDJ gene world? It corresponds to, do these two sequences, did they come from the same rearrangement event? Did they come from the same path through the HMM? So the point is that we can calculate, by marginalizing over all the possible paths, we can compare the probability that these sequences emerge from a single rearrangement event versus two independent rearrangement events.
So you're assuming that one path is really exactly the same choice of V number of insertions.
And also the nature of insertions.
Yeah, then the location of the deletion and so on.
Yeah, so it's exactly...
It is, I mean, I think, sorry, this assumes essentially that the path specifies the initial rearrangement.
Does it?
And that the only thing that goes into the emission is hyperlocations.
Is that not true?
That's right. That's the idea.
So let me think of the counterexample. Because in this idea of an HMM, if you're in a certain state, right, you can imagine that you have emission probabilities with inserting different nucleotides. Okay? That would be the same path. Right? So you cannot say it's the same.
Yeah, there's a level of complexity I'm not talking about, which I was going to just see if somebody...
Just to understand that you assume that the path actually specifies what you're
but there, yeah, yes, but there's more to the path than what you're thinking. So each non-templated insertion path has different states.
So if
as we're going through our HMM, we hit this hidden state, then that means that the inserted state was a G, and then differences from that G arise via mutations. So we're encoding.
So one path reads one sequence.
Path is a germline precursor.
Yes, one original. So you said is that true?
I thought you were saying that's not true.
No.
Okay, so you.
In order for what you said suggests that it must be true.
Okay.
So one path, one rearranged sequence.
Yes, yeah, naive rearranged sequence.
And then the different emissions correspond to
two mutations on top of that.
Mutations.
Yeah. This is part of that, because otherwise, if we just had sort of a generic insertion state,
then it wouldn't
do the same thing.
But you want this property, right? Because
yeah.
That gives you
more resolution.
But you still sum over different recombinations for one sequence, right? Because you don't know the recombination.
Yes, exactly. That's the whole idea.
Yeah.
That we're when we're evaluating the two terms of this, that we are summing over all the possible paths. So we're sort of using this recombination information, but we're not saying that we have to know it exactly. We're just saying that the two sequences have to have the same probabilities.
So basically going through recombination, let's say this combination produces both of them,
yeah.
Let's say this combination produces both of them,
right.
And on.
If we want...
comparing that to being produced from all the different...
recombination?
From independent, yeah.
Okay.
So sort of in a sort of an abstract context, we can think of this as just being a maximum likelihood clustering. So the likelihood of a given set, well, I didn't really talk about the clustering, but anyway, I'll just talk about this and we can talk about how to get it. I mean, this is the likelihood that we'd really like to optimize. So what is the likelihood of observing the series of sequences in a given set of clusters? We just take the product over all of the clusters, assuming that what's going on in each one of the clusters is an independent rearrangement event. So the way that we do that is using this likelihood ratio to do an agglomerative clustering. So we start with each one of these sequences. This is what we do. I'll explain why it's not exactly what we do in a minute, but we start with all the sequences being independent, and then we calculate this likelihood ratio for each pair. So what is the probability of emitting this pair together versus independently, together versus independently, and so on. And then we find the one that has the largest one of these likelihood ratios, and then we merge that. And then we effectively treat it as a single sequence, though it's a little bit more complicated than that. But you can think of we just treat it as everybody else, and then we calculate this likelihood ratio again and again. So the reason why we don't do it exactly like that is because this is like a very complicated computational problem. It's very computationally intensive. So we have some heuristics where we sort of, so for instance, if these two are too far away just in terms of like sequence, then we don't calculate it.
So, yeah,
so there's various levels of heuristics, but this is the sort of conceptual basis. So people aren't unhappy with this?
I mean, presumably, if you have two sequences with a very high probability of different Bs, there's no point in looking to see whether they're, say, clone, right? You might as well throw them on.
Lenses. So you have three lenses different.
Yeah.
Yep. So again, I don't want to go too much into our validation. This is not something that we've even put up on the archive yet, but this is just saying that this is the sensitivity, this is the precision. Red is the full implementation. These are various heuristics on top of that full implementation. But we are not quite as precise, so we do some false clustering, but we're, that's interesting. A heck of a lot more sensitive. So this blue line is where the clustering that you get by single linkage clustering if you enforce the same V, the same J, and 90% sequence identity in the CDR3. So if you're really interested in this, I suggest that we talk afterwards, but where this is sort of ongoing validation. But it's not, I mean, this thing that people use, this VJCDR3 thing, is pretty rough. So it's not too surprising that we do somewhat better. Okay, so as far as likelihood-based clustering, the only thing that I'm aware of is this phylogenetic empirical Bayes method for computing unmutated common ancestors. It's not even actually a clustering, but it's sort of related. What I just told you about. Anybody know anything else?
Simon? What do the Feinstein people?
They do something like this VJCDR3 thing, but they have a fancier distance, and that's this line here.
We do a crummy version where we just look at the J values
and then
we can just bang certain ones together, which recruit.
But at least it allows some sort of uncertainty in the annotations. Yeah. Okay. So now this is the really new stuff, reconstructing BCR phylogenetic trees. So I don't mean to bait and switch. I'm not quite yet inferring lots of phylogenetic trees, but we're sort of setting up the framework for doing so. So just as a motivation slide, this is the Doria Rose paper concerning the broadly neutralizing antibodies. I just think it's really beautiful that they sort of built this tree and they calculated lots of characteristics of the various tips of the tree. Doria Rose, it's Peter Kwong and Sean Maskell, broadly neutralizing antibody paper. It's definitely worth having a look. It's a thick paper, though. They put a lot of analysis into it. Okay, so just a reminder about likelihood-based phylogenetics. You imagine that you have that your sequence is encountering mutations at some rate lambda. So we start at some ancestral sequence, and then there's mutations that occur according to a Poisson process with rate lambda. And then when there is a mutation, it changes bases according to a substitution matrix. So what this is saying is, if we were a G and then we're mutating to an A, then we do that with this probability. So that's basically how phylogenetics works. Traditional, so if you sort of run Mr. Bayes or RaxML or any of these programs, it's the typical classical way that it's done is that you assume that the same evolutionary processes happening at each site. So there might be a mixture of rates and so on, but it's the same across sites. But, I mean, this is manifestly not true. So if we look at the mutation frequency for, say, a given V gene, and these are the different sites of the V gene, there's some sites that are very likely to have a substitution and some that are not. I mean, this is some combination of the hypermutation machinery and biochemical constraints. I don't think this should be too controversial, but...
The three colors are what?
Three colors are the three individuals. And so this is the other important point, is that not only is it not constant across site, it's sort of consistently non-constant. So it's sort of like we see the same pattern for each of the three individuals. Purple is scaled up a little bit compared to everybody else because that individual had just an overall higher rate of somatic hypermutation.
Is this base pairs or?
This is nucleotides, yes.
Yeah.
So this assumption, same process happening in each site, does not hold for B cell receptor sequences. Should not be controversial. So.
Yeah, I don't think it ever holds. But
what?
I don't think it holds in phylogenetics either, but people do that way.
Right. But I mean, so for instance, this paper, they make that assumption. I mean, so they.
But sir, this is more a question about phylogenetic inference. I mean, there is such an idea as a mutation hotspot. So you're saying that there is no software that incorporates this idea?
It does via a mixture model. So the mixture model, you don't assume that you know a priori what the hotspots are versus the not hotspots. So typically in phylogenetics, you don't, like, the phylogenetic software has to be prepared for any old gene you dump into it. So my point is that here, we're looking again and again and again and again at the same gene. So we can use that. We can use the structure of these mutation matrices and sort of...
Okay.
So as Thierry showed, this can be explained in part by context-sensitive mutations, but there's probably also some other position-specific effects, for instance, having to do with selection. So one might think, okay, well, what we need to do is do phylogenetics in a way where we can use this context-sensitive substitution. And this is very, very hard and for the following reason. So here we have three sequences that only differ sort of by these inner two nucleotides. It's AG over here, and then it's CC and G and CG. So according to what we just saw before, the sort of rate with which this G transitions maybe back and forth from a C depends on what these other nucleotides are. But if we go back in sort of our likelihood framework, we don't know, if we're wanting to calculate the rate of that mutation, we don't know, were we ancestrally in this previous position, were we a C, or were we an A? So it gets very, very difficult to understand what these ancestral sequences are. And likelihood-based phylogenetic inference, you really have to be able to calculate what the marginal probability or what the probability of seeing each one of these ancestral sequences was as you go back in time. So maybe if that that description didn't make sense, you can just believe me that here are some of the papers where people have tried to do this, and basically there's sort of no really solid way, efficient way to do it. It's sort of just an inherently difficult problem. So
it's not from Jeff Thorpe, basically looking at huge transition matrices across sequences rather than across characters, where you have fitness function attached to each of those.
That is not represented in this list, I don't think. But
it's hard as well.
It's hard, is the point. Okay, so here we are. We're over here. So on one hand, we have like not using this very wonderful sequence information, and on the other hand, we have all of our time getting sucked down by trying to solve this very difficult problem in phylogenetics. So I'd like to propose some alternative special sauce, which is sort of obvious in retrospect. So each site of every germline gene gets its own substitution rate and mutation rate matrix. So this sounds fine until you realize that if we have 350 germline genes, and there's sort of five parameters here, I've used a simplified mutation matrix here, five parameters, and then about 300 sites, that's rather a lot of parameters. So we can't just sort of be naive about the way that we go about estimating these parameters. This is just the V gene. So we need to be careful, and the way I propose being careful has to do with the deep phylogeny of the B cell receptor genes. So I want to be very clear, we're making a shift here. Before I was talking about within host trees of B cell receptor sequences. Now I'm talking about deep time. So this is going back to the common ancestor of like the V1 genes and the V7 genes and stuff like that. So all these genes arose via duplication and so on. And so this is a reconstruction of a phylogenetic tree of a subset of 50 of these genes.
These are the germline genes.
So now regarding your parameter count, why can't you just sort of parameterize your site-specific substitution matrix by the sequence context in the germline?
You could do that, but I think that, we haven't done a formal comparison yet, but I think that this will have a sort of a richer, better model. But yes, you're right, you could do that. But even that is rather a lot of parameters. Okay, so I'm going to show the results of a little experiment here, where we're going to take 20 genes for which we have a whole lot of data. This is from a single individual from that Kleinstein group paper, the second data set. So these, I feel quite happy that we can fit these per site models. I mean, these are tens of thousands of sequences, so that's sort of sufficient to fit these per site models.
So you then have alleles for each of the genes?
Well, that comes in this, about 350. Mm. Oh, here I don't. This is a reduced tree. This is just 50. The whole tree was sort of too big.
So what's the 10,000 sequences? I mean, if you have 50 genes.
No, this is 10,000 per, sorry, I should say alleles, gene alleles. So
right, okay.
We take the 20 alleles, genes plus alleles, for which we have the most data. So this is.
And the data means that these alleles
number of reads
are used you identify them in reads.
Yeah. So we're going to fit these models for these 20 genes. We can compare the parameter fits, and then we're going to compare how different these parameter fits are versus the evolutionary distance. So the evolutionary distance here is sort of how far is it to get from this allele to another allele.
Your goal is to identify somatic hypermutations on the V genes.
Let me show a plot, and then we'll see. What my eventual goal is to like build better models for phylogenetics.
Yeah, but I'm just confused because I understand the goal of
We're going on a bit of a detour here.
Yeah.
I'll bring us back. Okay. Okay. So this is we're still on the detour. So each point here is a pair of germline genes from that set of 20. So given that, we can fit parameters. And then on one hand, for this axis, we can compute how far it is from one place to another in the tree. On this axis, we can calculate how different are the rate parameters. So how similar are the inferred sets of rate parameters? This is just for the mutation rate.
But these are the somatic hypermutations.
These are somatic hypermutations.
So Q inferred.
So this over here is evolutionary. Okay. This is between gene deep time evolution. And this is shallow time evolution that happens within an individual.
Okay, so can you explain your intuition why we would expect them to be correlated?
So this is saying that similar sequences evolve similarly. And that's not too surprising to me. I mean, on one hand, would they have...
So in a way, what you could be doing is that this means that you could identify a local sequence background for the mutations, like Richard was proposing.
Yes, though, I mean, I think that we can do something more direct.
Okay.
Debra, anything else?
Okay, I'm just thinking a little bit circular.
Okay, so that was for mutation rates, perhaps the sort of correlation for, this is pi, where we take the Kullback-Leibler divergence between the pi vectors is perhaps not so good. So what I'm, the only reason I'm showing, and this is sort of, now we're doing the, just the other one, which is the mutation rate versus pi. But this doesn't actually have another
idea. The previous plots really looked as if there are two groups, right?
Yeah, so that's...
And you're basically uncorrelated within each group.
I don't think they're uncorrelated within each group, but basically what we're, these are the set of genes. The reason why, of course, we have clumps is we have sort of within gene family comparisons and then between gene family comparisons.
These are top 20 by usage? Or?
By number of sequences. So they're in a given experiment.
Oh, okay, fine, so that's usage.
So the only reason I'm using this is to motivate a regularization strategy. So in order to explain that, let's look at a multiple sequence alignment of the V3 germline. So I'm quite accustomed to looking at these things. Perhaps you are not. But what we have here are all of the V3 genes are on the rows, and then along the top are the columns of the alignment. And so a multiple sequence alignment basically is saying that all of the sites here, so these again are the different genes, all of the different sites that are in a column arose, if they differ, they only differ because of point mutation, not because of insertion or deletion. So this block, for instance, This multiple sequence alignment is proposing that these are not homologous, like this site here is not homologous to this site here, because this arose via some ancestral sort of duplication deletion event. Are people happy with this? So I need to be able to talk about columns of an alignment.
So you're in trouble basically on the symbol.
No, this is the V.
This is the V gene.
You have a lot of V genes here, right?
Yeah. So V3 is a very big family. These are all the alleles and so on.
All the alleles found in the V3. For one family of these.
For V3, yeah.
So here you have an insertion. Is that the idea?
So, the idea is just to explain what a column of an alignment is.
Yeah, but I just to understand why that block doesn't, I mean, I would like it to fit in there. Transposition, really. I would find that more aesthetically pleasing. So
what this is, so this is actually a phylogenetic alignment program, and what it does is it tries to identify places in the tree where there were insertions. So what this is, or insertions or deletions. So this is saying that there was some uncertain insertion, say, in the middle of there's an event, and then that differentiates.
Sorry, so in this multiple sequence alignment, you have different genes and different alleles of these genes.
Yes.
So there's a further level of blocks.
Yeah.
Sounds like you actually have 140 genes in there, so yeah. How many genes do you have?
I don't know. I mean, how many V3 genes?
V3 dash something.
Yeah.
And how many things?
No. And everything that is yellow or white
is just a gap. I mean, so that's just filler for saying that like this column here is not homologous to this. You need to put some space.
It's a gap for the other sequences.
Yeah.
So for instance, this one column. Slender column, which is all yellow, just because of this one point over there, all the rest has to fall for open gap. Okay.
Okay, so the idea is that we assume that sites in the same column evolve similarly within hosts. So we're going to do this in a Bayesian modeling framework by saying that we're going to be taking priors. But the basic idea is that when the data is weak, when we don't have sufficient data, then we're going to pull everything back to a per column average. So I don't know what our time is like, but basically the point is that we draw our substitution rate from a gamma distribution that's parameterized by the columns. So we have the mode and the dispersion on a per column level. And there's sort of multiple levels of hierarchy. We don't actually do anything fancy with the stationary distribution. Okay. Oh. Well, whatever that slide was, it's not there. So this is the outcome of what we get. So let me just walk you through this plot. So here we're just looking at the mutation rates for a given gene. So here on this top column is just the mutation rate estimated. We can't really interpret this so much unless it's in terms of a relative rate. This is because all the rates for a given gene are normalized to one. So these are the rate estimations. This is what the stationary, what this pi in this mutation rate looks like. And you can see that these pi estimates are rather different than the normalized counts. So the point is that we're not just taking the normalized counts, for instance, for the stationary distribution for the mutation matrix. So
the stationary would be what you get if you wait say an infinite amount of time so that every position gets mutated multiple times.
Yes. So, and it's a little bit of there's a technical reason why that's a bit of a silly thing to talk about here, but it's basically this.
Is it more like the eigenvector, the stationary state of
the... Nope, it's precisely this. So the idea when we're talking about phylogenetic, I'm not going to go back to that slide, but we had that slide with the lightning bolt. So whenever there's a mutation, the question is, what are we mutating to?
Are you saying it doesn't depend what you can?
In this, so we're taking a reduced model where it doesn't matter where it came from,
okay.
Because we know where we came from in germline.
So stationary at the first step.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. That's an astute point. But basically, what I'm showing is what are the different mutation probabilities.
Can you show them again?
Here's a zoomed-in version for just the first collection, I guess this is the tail end.
So what's a normalized count is how often you see it?
A given base, yeah, at a given site in this. So what this is the fact that, for instance, this one here, so this one was germline T, that's why it's green. And we see some mutation to blue and purple. And so that's what's reflected here. And then it doesn't exclude the possibility that you could have also had a mutation to G.
Okay, but it tells you that position is very likely to be mutated.
If it's, so this one here is somewhat likely to be mutated. Yeah. But if it is mutated, then this is what it mutates to.
Okay.
I
understand the nature of the result, and I understood the Abdin tool, but I'm missing the, how do you get these results?
So,
I mean, you find the substitution matrix based on your alignment. What do you need the
phylogenetic tree goes into this effectively. So that was motivation for treating homologous sites in different genes similarly.
Okay, but you never showed this homologous. When you did the alignment, you did it within one gene family. Okay, but I get.
But there's others. Yeah.
So other.
So this is sort of the same. So I
don't understand what you gain over a position like a background sequence model, because you're saying this is sort of more
a background sequence model.
This is more direct. It's just direct.
But you need more parameters.
Yeah.
But we have strategies to regularize them, so. It's important to do so, for sure.
But would you, I mean, you've shown the evidence in a way. Okay, yeah. It's more direct. But
there's also one other important point, which is this is a substitution model. This is not a mutation model. And the reason why it's important that it's a substitution model is if you're building phylogenetic trees, what you're observing are substitutions. And so you model substitutions in the continuous time recovery chain framework. And these are the parameters for that.
Okay, but you could imagine that you assume that there's some background that once you've identified, right?
There's, yes.
But presumably, at least, I mean, you maybe haven't showed this, but your gut intuition is that would do worse than doing the direct model.
Well, there's one thing I know for sure, which is calculating likelihoods for sites for context-specific models is hard. So if we want to, so the title of my talk is Scalable Methods. That doesn't mean that I have solved all the scaling problems, but in principle, one can use this sort of model to efficiently compute trees without like a tremendous penalty versus just a standard rates across sites.
And can you give some intuition why context-dependent models are hard for this?
Or? I tried to with this. So basically, I mean, maybe I've tried once. I don't know.
Don't factorize the likelihood on sites.
Yeah.
Here you don't need to because you just go along the chain.
You basically treat each site as independent, but it's an independent but special for that particular site.
Yeah.
But isn't that kind of the same as just in context with respect to the germline as opposed to.
Well, it's context, but then there's also, like I say, these selection. Level effects.
I think what Zach is saying that if you took the context of the germline rather than the last common ancestor, you lose that problem of the old.
That's absolutely correct.
So it's probably not. I mean, it's not realistic, right? How could you remember the germline? But it's simple.
Yep.
Each mutation is sparse enough.
Yeah, that's a good estimate.
And you have when you say you regularize, I assume you assume sparseness.
The regularization is to keep the parameters from overfitting.
Right, but you probably assume some sparseness when you're doing that.
What's a typical parameter, right?
You want to run all the substitution rates at both positions.
This is the regularization that you take a prior on the substitution rate. So for instance, if we have a given site and we never observe it being mutated, the maximum likelihood estimate for that is zero mutation rate. That's of course silly. So the idea is you take a prior. This is a per column prior.
Okay.
So what I'm would
so you assume
that the evolutionary distance between everything is the same as the somatic hypermutation difference between everything?
So what I'm assuming is that similar sequences, closely related sequences in deep time, evolve more similarly.
So there is that connection there between the somatic hypermutation preferences and the evolutionary preferences.
In a sense, though, it's maybe just a proxy for sequence similarity. I mean, we could just say similar sequences evolve separately and maybe not invoke the deep evolutionary time story. But it's a way of, I mean, these things do fit nicely into an evolutionary tree, so it's a way of formalizing that. Yeah, Quentin?
So you talk about different substitution and mutation, what do you mean by this?
Yeah, so substitution is sort of the aggregate effect of mutation and selection. So when we're building a tree, typically one does not separate out the effects of mutation and selection. Because we just have observed sequences where they came from. I don't actually know what my time is like, but.
It's 20%.
Okay. Maybe, I mean, so we can do this for different genes. Some genes we have a lot of information for, so we can see. Oh, I didn't actually explain what was going on in this slide. So each one of these points is a rate estimate for an individual germline gene slash allele. So what this is saying is there is a specific gene here that at this site, we estimate it had a mutation rate of, what, 10 to the minus 1 or something like that. And these triangles are the 95% confidence interval of the prior. So the idea is that these priors are gathering things together on a per column level, but between columns, they're allowed to move up and down. Anybody wants to ask a question?
So what you can do with these models? It's nice to have probabilistic models, but what do you actually?
Well, I mean,
intrinsic interest, or is it sort of what you can do with them in terms of the biology?
Yeah, I want to use them to build trees, and I want to use them to estimate selection pressure. So we'll be talking about selection pressure next. So anyway, we can estimate, like, so what this is, maybe I'll just forget this and this one too. But the idea is that we can estimate the rate of mutation according to the prior, the sort of aggregate across the V gene. And these are marked here, the CDRs, CDR 1, 2, and just a bit of 3 in the VG. So of course we see that. But I just think it's kind of interesting that we also see, you know, other peaks of likelihood that are outside of these. Whether these are meaningful or not, I think will have to come from comparing them between individuals, seeing what happens, if we see this reproducibly. And we can, of course, make nice heat maps where this is just a different way of seeing the same thing. We have all the different V genes that we observed in this individual. These are different positions and the mutation rates, where red is highly mutated and blue is not. Okay, so if you don't take away anything else, just remember that you can use likelihood-based phylogenetics analysis, but if you just use an off-the-shelf program, it's going to assume models where evolution is identical across sites. Substitution is definitely not identical across sites for B-cell phylogenetics. So we could work to do phylogenetics with context-sensitive models, but we're doing this per-site parameter thing. We're still a long way from inferring trees with these models. I have like a complete hack piece of software that does this, but we need to build better software. There's this other thing that I haven't talked about that perhaps you all are aware that in a phylogenetic tree, you usually assume that we just sample the leaves here. And then you reconstruct what all these ancestors are. But of course, in B cell receptors and also for viruses as well, you can observe these internal nodes. So coming up with methods where you can allow observations of these internal nodes is also something that needs to be done better. there's some beginning work. Okay. So another application of this these sorts of models is finding these ancestral sequences. Just another beautiful application from this broadly neutralizing antibody literature. They actually took the observed sequences and then they transfected the predicted ancestral sequence going back in time. So this I2 is this one right here, and then they can actually infer the binding properties of this ancestral antibody. So we want to do as good of a job as we can of
So could you say again what these...
So these are observed tips.
Got an observed sequence there. They go the tree to find out.
Infer what this ancestral sequence was.
That's the super ancestral sequence. That's just one sequence along the way.
This is one sequence along the way. This is another ancestral sequence up here. And then they also infer this one. And then they build these things in the lab, and then they do binding assays on them.
Okay, and I should see that.
You should see that as you're going, yeah.
The
binding gets stronger as you go towards this tip. So I actually don't have very much to say about this besides that they were doing this with identical across-sites models, and we will be doing it with per-site models. And it won't be hard once we sort of have the rest of this framework going. So there's just one more part of the talk. Can I just?
Okay.
So we saw before in Thierry's talk a means of estimating selection pressure in BCR sequences, and that involved looking for preferences of certain amino acids at specific sites. This is different than that. This is a little bit closer to the way the people typically infer selection pressure in population, well, in sort of in evolution, in phylogenetics. So the idea is that you're interested in what is the selection pressure for an amino acid at a given site. And you take you divide your mutations into two classes, the synonymous and non-synonymous ones. The synonymous ones, of course, don't change the underlying amino acid, and the non-synonymous ones do. So the idea is that in your selection analysis, if you see a whole lot of synonymous mutations, that means that there was probably some background mutation, but the ones that were mutated got thrown out of the population. So that means if we see an excess of synonymous rate, then we think that there's some purifying selection happening at that site, i.e. that amino acid wants to stay the same, versus if you see a lot of non-synonymous mutations, then that amino acid is sort of willing to change, or it's actually even favored to change. This is the standard way that DNDS analysis. So, of course, there's this like challenge that in antibodies we have this context-sensitive mutation. So the combination of this context-sensitive process and this selection process can sort of make things complicated. So for a selection analysis, we also infer, using the Adafrim sequences, we infer a background mutation rate, and then we can use that in our DNDS analysis. So we, is this clear?
So this is how you say, I mean, because you need an out group, right? To sort of, when you calculate your substitutions, your synonymous substitutions, you need to,
So this is the background rate of mutation, and then we have the selection pressure that's happening on top of that. So with this is showing the synonymous rate for the outer frame sequences.
Okay.
And this is the same story as we saw before, that we have three individuals. It matters where you are. But different individuals appear to have similar rates of background mutation. And this is probably not terribly surprising. I mean, this probably has to do with what the context sensitivity is. I should say this is just for a specific gene. This is for one gene. And again, it differs between genes, but it's similar between individuals. So this gives us our estimate of the neutral mutation rate. And then this is the way that we do our selection analysis, that we just, all we do, this is our DN, this is our non-synonymous rate, and this is our synonymous rate, but we just normalize by this per site rate estimate of the background mutation. Okay, so now we have a per site, per gene estimate of mutation rate. This actually coming up with this takes rather a lot of work, but you can then take all of these estimates and use a multiple sequence alignment of the various genes and smash them down on top of one another. And so that's what is shown here. Here are the different sites. Now we're in sort of codon world because selection happens on the level of codons. And we, you know, this is a violin plot showing the distribution of selection pressures at that given site. So down here is purifying selection, meaning that that amino acid wants to stay the same. Something that's up here is sort of diversifying mutation. We can also classify what the mutation, like the selective regime, based on does the posterior on this selection parameter exclude zero with the 95% confidence interval. So correspondingly, for the each position, we have what is the number of sites that are estimated to be under purifying selection, neutral, or we can't infer selection versus a diversifying selection in blue. So I just put a star here because that's sort of a highly purifying selection. Yeah, we'll see a pretty picture of it. Okay, so and as if we couldn't, we needed to say this again, it's sort of similar across individuals. So remember, now we're not looking at like a mutation estimate across the sites. We're looking at a selection estimate, but this again is similar across individuals.
So overall, this strong purifying selection.
Yes. I mean, sort of for me, this is a little bit surprising, given that.
These are loops.
Well, let's see, this is, the CDR3 starts here, it goes over there. But I guess what's sort of interesting to me is that sort of this is called framework and this is called CDR, but there's sort of more interesting things than you can say other than just framework. I mean, obviously there are some sites that you really need to stay the same and some other sites that you don't. So this is sort of a more detailed picture than that. Okay, so that one particular site was actually this one here, and it's a tyrosine, I believe. Isn't that what this looks like? Anyway, I think it's tyrosine. And the, I mean, the story that we can spin about it is that this tyrosine is sort of there to stabilize the rest of the structure of the heavy chain. So this whole thing is the heavy chain. We have, this is a crystal structure with a ligand up here, and this is the light chain over here. So in red, again, as we saw in the previous slides, that's purifying selection, and then blue is diversifying selection. And this sort of thing, the story about whether the selection is, you know, has to do with sort of is something embedded deep in the protein versus outside of the protein, that holds up with statistical analysis.
Could you somehow use deep evolution to confirm that? You might expect that tyrosine then to be.
Huh. That's interesting. I hadn't thought about that. Okay. So right, this I mean, the Kleinstein group has this way of doing selection analysis, but it's sort of aggregate. It's sort of saying there's selection for this on this particular sequence, but it's not a per-site estimate. So these amino acid preferences that we heard about in Thierry's talk, that's another sort of framework for thinking about selection inference, but this is our per-site selection inference analysis. Okay. So just stepping back a little bit, in the observed repertoires that we have are some function of health and genetics and age. And we would like to make this relationship explicit by developing probabilistic methods with priors in terms of these covariates. So, you know, what do our priors look like for a sick person versus a healthy person, or sort of an African person versus a Caucasian person, and so on. And so we've seen a lot of, you know, more sort of mechanistic models in this conference, and that's very interesting. But we'll probably be taking a slightly different approach, sort of a more abstract statistical perspective, where we're inferring lots of collections of parameters and then trying to figure out, you know, what are the influence of these various factors. Okay, so I guess another message from the talk is we don't need all sorts of different little tools for different doing different little things. We really just need one principle. Okay, so I'll stop there.